We're talking about the world food crisis on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The United Nations says more than 800 million people are going hungry, the pandemic causing tens of millions more people to be undernourished across the world. Russia's war in Ukraine is intensifying the dire situation. Join in on food systems, food security, industrialized agriculture, disruptions to global food supplies, 800-642-1234. Rebecca Middleton is Chief Advocacy and Engagement Officer for the World Food Program USA, a nonprofit working to end global hunger and supporting the mission of the UN World Food Program. Rebecca, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. We've heard the warnings that world hunger is a perfect storm and that food might be the world's biggest security crisis at the moment. What is your assessment of the global food situation as it stands?
Well, I wish we were having this conversation 5 years ago, because at that time, the news was good. The numbers were down. The trend was exactly what we, who've all been working in this space, hope to see. But unfortunately, even before the pandemic, the numbers started to shift in the wrong direction. The number of hungry people around the world increased. And then between COVID-19 and the economic shocks of that, and then, of course, the rising costs of food and fuel related to the crisis in Ukraine, I don't have good news to share, which is why it's great to have the chance to share this with you and your listeners. So in just 2 years, the number of severely food insecure people has doubled. If we were having this conversation 2 years ago, it would have been about 135 million people just before the pandemic. And now we're looking at 276 million people. Mm. And these are situations where, this is affecting lives, this is affecting livelihoods. And for 750,000 people, it really is a matter of life and death.
What are the distinctions there? Because there's nuance between food insecurity, hunger, starvation. Can you just give us more of a idea of what that is?
Absolutely. So I'll give you sort of the technical piece of it, and then I can give it the more human piece of it. So there is a system that's used fairly universally called the integrated phase classification. And this looks at household risk of food insecurity, and it's on a scale from 1 to 5, 1 being none, minimal, people know where their next meal is coming from, where their next many meals are coming from. And when we talk about the number of people facing hunger in the world, that 800 plus number that you look at, we're looking at crisis level and above. So that's level 3 through level 5. So level 3 is where communities, families, don't know where their food is coming from. They're having to figure it out on a day-by-day basis. They're able to meet their minimum food needs, but that's also at the expense of nutrition. Mm. And then that increases to emergency situations. This is larger gaps, going a day or more without much to eat. Some of the stories that you're seeing from different places, portions of Afghanistan, although unfortunately there are communities in Afghanistan that are even facing the higher level, which is catastrophe. That is where people's lives are at risk due to a lack of food, quite simply. And unfortunately, there's plenty of food in the world. It's a matter of access and then political will.
That's what is really boggling to me, because, I was reading the World Bank's food security update from last week, and it said the outlook for global food supplies remains favorable, but globally, hunger levels remain alarmingly high. What is that disconnect between food supplies and starvation?
Well, it's a few factors. When we talk about sort of the drivers of hunger globally, it used to be the two C's, which are conflict and climate, and those still are very much the case, particularly conflict-driven hunger. And then you add in the COVID economic shocks, and now the increased cost. And in a lot of situations, there is food available, but because of the economic crisis, again, this is very clear in Afghanistan, people just can't buy food. They don't have money to buy food. And so there are a lot of different interventions that the World Food Program uses to meet the needs, whether it's a situation such as in Yemen, where there just isn't food available, or a situation like many parts of the world where there are markets, but just not the economic access to purchase food in those markets.
We're going to look more closely at your organization and interventions here. I'm just going to read to you, talking with Rebecca Middleton, Chief Advocacy and Engagement Officer at World Food Program USA, as we look at the causes and effects of global hunger. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Rebecca, if you could step back and help us understand, what is your role at World Food Program USA in working on this global food crisis?
Sure. I get to tell the story, the good story of the World Food Program's work and the impact that they've had for the past 60 years, saving lives and changing lives around the world. So I talk to policymakers, particularly members of Congress, both representatives and senators, and tell them about the impact of the work, the lives that are saved, the lives that are changed, and then also advocate for continued U.S. support. The United States has been a tremendous supporter and donor to the World Food Program since its inception. They do that through cash, so providing dollars to the World Food Program that they can then use in the best way possible. Sometimes that's buying food and taking it into a country or a community. And other times, but very often, it is transferring cash in places where that's the barrier to food. The U.S. also provides U.S. commodities. So this is wheat, corn, soy, sorghum, lentils that are grown by U.S. farmers and send those around the world to places where there isn't food available. And so it's a really, I love this job. It's so much fun to tell these good stories of the successes. I'll admit it's sometimes challenging to just see crisis after crisis building on each other. And last year, around this time, we're talking about Ethiopia and the crisis in the Tigray region. And then late last summer, Afghanistan becomes the story. And then earlier this year, obviously, Ukraine becomes the story. And even as these new stories emerge, it doesn't mean the previous ones go away. So that's part of what we do too, is just try and keep the scope and range of the global need front and center with U.S. policymakers. Now, the World Food Program USA does that on a broader scale with the American public as well. So it's really just telling the story, talking about the need, but also letting folks know that there's something that we can do about this, both as a country and as individuals.
And the American public has also seen food prices increase sharply, as numerous countries also experiencing this high food inflation at the retail level. How are rising food costs affecting hunger domestically here in America?
Well, it's not something that I'm as familiar with because I do focus on the international hunger issues, but mm-hmm. obviously it's a factor, particularly for folks with limited budgets or who are supported by the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. That's a fixed dollar amount and unfortunately doesn't quickly adjust for things such as rapid inflation. So a number of my colleagues who focus on the domestic hunger side of things can probably provide a lot more information, but clearly this is something that is global in scale. And the shocks are being felt in every community around the world in one way or another.
What is the U.S.'s approach to global food aid? How do you see the Biden administration responding to this crisis when there are so many other crises at hand?
One of the reasons I love this issue in this world that we're in is that it's such a bipartisan issue. There is incredible support on both sides of the aisle for the U.S.'s leadership in international food assistance. We've seen this just this year in a couple of circumstances. One was a group of Republican and Democrat senators and members of Congress got together and encouraged the Biden administration to tap into an emergency resource of funding called the Bill Emerson Humanitarian Trust. This is used to purchase more of those U.S. commodities to send overseas. And as a result, there were $282 million unlocked by the administration to send these U.S. commodities to Yemen, Ethiopia, Sudan, South Sudan, Kenya, and Somalia. So it's really a unifying issue. Everybody sees the importance of this investment in the world. And I think that we've got strong allies on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue.
Rebecca Middleton, Chief Advocacy and Engagement Officer at World Food Program USA, as we look at what it means to have tens of millions of people on the brink of famine around the world. Join in on food systems, on global hunger relief. Your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Rebecca Middleton here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing world food insecurity here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The head of the UN World Food Program, David Beasley, addressed the United Nations Security Council last month, delivering dire statistics.
The numbers have escalated in terms of those marching to starvation from 80 million to 135 before COVID, and then because of COVID, 135 to 276 million people marching to starvation, and that number, because of the Ukrainian crisis, will rise to 323 million at least.
Join in on food insecurity. Your questions about addressing world hunger, implications on stability, 800-642-1234. Rebecca Middleton is Chief Advocacy and Engagement Officer for World Food Program USA with us for about 9 more minutes. Rebecca, we hear David Beasley there with those real dire warnings, and I'm wondering about the situation compounding in Ukraine as your organization purchases, a lot of its wheat supply from Ukraine and the country's ports being blockaded. What effect is the war having?
It's having multiple levels of impact. It's both the cost of the food and then also the cost of the fuel that it's taking to get food from one place to another. So it's a couple of different levels. You mentioned that there is plenty of food in Ukraine. Before the conflict, Ukraine and Russia together provided 50% of the wheat that the World Food Program uses. And most of that goes to East Africa, Horn of Africa, Yemen region. And so that's the area that's been most profoundly impacted by the crisis, simply because, as you mentioned, the wheat isn't able to get out of Ukraine in particular at the rate that it had previously. This is why I mentioned earlier that Emerson Trust funding is so critical, because it's going directly to help those places in the world most dramatically impacted. But the practical piece is that it's just costing more to feed the same number of people. And there's already a significant gap between what's available and what's needed. And so it just means that, unfortunately, the World Food Program's having to make more hard choices. And as David Beasley has said, take from the hungry to give to the starving.
Mm. Are there grain silos that are still at capacity in Ukraine that can't be accessed because of the war? What is the situation like of grain that is in country, can't get out of country?
I'm not familiar with that in the detail that some of my colleagues from the UN World Food Program might be. Mm-hmm. I do know that there are just challenges. For instance, the train system, there are different gauged tracks in Ukraine than there are in the rest of Western Europe. And so they have to manually unload grain from one train car to another to cross those borders. It's those kind of challenges that are just slowing down the ability to get the grain out of the country.
Let's bring on a caller. Matt is joining us from Johnson Creek. Matt, hi, go ahead.
Hi, my question is, what is the feasibility of moving away from certain grains that are trapped in Europe, so to speak, and maybe moving to products like soy that actually we had a surplus and the market took a hit during COVID and the trade war with China? Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. What do you make of that, Rebecca?
Thanks for the question, Matt. We're obviously interested in all options available. Soy is a critical part of the overall commodities that the World Food Program uses. I actually had the opportunity to talk to a group of U.S. soy farmers at Commodity Classic earlier this year. And I mean, talk about a group of anti-hunger advocates. This is right after the crisis in Ukraine started. And they were asking the same kind of question. How can we, U.S. soy farmers, help with this crisis? And so soy is a critical part. Corn soy blend is something that you see all over the world, nicely stamped with a gift from the people of the United States. So it's definitely in the mix. And I think certainly is part of the solution.
What is the role of U.S. farmers in the current situation in this global crisis?
Well, it's absolutely vital, and obviously U.S. farmers are facing some of their own challenges too, with prices rising on some of the inputs, and climate challenges here in the U.S. But the U.S. farmer, I've met scores of U.S. farmers over my time in the anti-hunger space, and there are no greater anti-hunger advocates, allies, champions, heroes than U.S. farmers. And there, like I mentioned earlier, there are a couple of programs that buy U.S. commodities. I mentioned the Emerson Trust a couple of times, but there's also something called Title II Food for Peace. And this is something that's provided through annual appropriations and that consistently buys these great high quality, high nutrition inputs for the World Food Program to provide to folks around the world. And I will say in the first Ukraine supplemental funding bill that Congress passed a couple of months ago, there was an additional $100 million for that Food for Peace program as well.
We're talking about the impact of global hunger with Rebecca Middleton. She's Chief Advocacy and Engagement Officer at World Food Program USA. You can join in with your questions about food insecurity globally, 800-642-1234. Rebecca, I just want to bounce this off of you as well. There are these new reports of a global fertilizer shortage, and Bloomberg is reporting that the U.S. wants companies to ramp up buying Russian fertilizer. What can you tell us as this relates to crop production and food shortages?
Yeah, I wasn't familiar with that, so thanks for sharing that. But I do know that this has been part of the conversation almost from the beginning. Obviously, concerns about getting commodities out of Ukraine, but also realizing the impact this was going to have on inputs, like I just mentioned. And I know it's a concern. There's rising cost, there's limited supply. I've heard anecdotes that this is also a challenge for some of the smallholder farmers in Africa. So this is another global ripple effect that is impacting food, the cost of food, and the availability of food.
There are people hearing this and feeling hopeless that they can't do anything on their own to solve this. What would you say?
There is so much that we can do as individuals and as communities. If you don't mind, I'm going to start with just sharing a quick story from a recent trip I took to El Salvador. So the World Food Program saves lives, and that's the stories that we see on nightly news of where they're going into the most extreme circumstances and truly saving lives, but they also change lives. And I was in El Salvador, I met a young man, he was about 20, and he told me that because of the support from the World Food Program there, and this was not in life-saving food necessarily, but this was investments in livelihoods. This was resilience building programs around irrigation for fields and to increase agriculture yields and skills building around what to do with this food. How do you add value to it? How do you get it to market? He told me all of his friends from growing up had migrated, but that he was staying. He wanted to stay in El Salvador, and he was able to do it because of the investments that the World Food Program was making there. So the things that we can do, learn about the work and the opportunity and the positive stories, talk to your friends and family, talk to your elected officials. And of course, if you're able to and interested, you can donate. And you can find resources for all of these things. You can find information, you can find advocacy opportunities on our website, which I'll put a plug for. It's wfpusa.org.
So it's really also about educating yourself on what is happening. So maybe you think differently about your food if you're in the category of you don't have to figure out where that next meal is coming from.
Oh, absolutely. And there are so many ways to learn about that and think about that, both what our neighbors in the U.S. are experiencing, who don't know where they're going to get their food for this month, or where our neighbors across the ocean are experiencing as these conflict, climate, and other crises impact their ability to feed themselves and their families. So there's so much information out there. It's thankfully been getting a lot of coverage, and that's why we're so grateful to be here with you today too, is to be able to talk about it a bit. But again, our website is a resource. You can Google what can I do to help with hunger and find additional resources. And again, just as you talk to folks, let them know that this is a solvable problem and there are things that we can do, even though it feels so big and so overwhelming, even a little bit makes a difference. It costs just under $1 a day to feed a family in and out through the World Food Program. And so as they're having to make these decisions of taking food from the hungry to give to the starving, any little bit can help make those decisions less difficult because the resources will be there.
Rebecca, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to be with you, Kate.
Rebecca Middleton is the Advocacy and Engagement Officer for the World Food Program USA. Ahead this hour, we get an update from a UW Eau Claire political science professor on the January 6th hearings at the U.S. Capitol. And you can join in on your takeaways after 2 days of hearings, 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network.